Hello, everyone. Today we are able to continue our series of interfaith dialogue by having our special guest, Rida Hamida, speaking about her Islamic faith. Rida is an unapologetically proud Palestinian-American Muslim woman. And I'm going to do a bio right now just to show you how amazing it is that we have her here. All right, so bear with me. Don't worry, I'll be done talking soon. We'll let her have the mic and do most of the talking. So, Rida Hamida is the founder and director of Latino Muslim Unity, the first grassroots movement that intentionally unites Latino and Muslim communities through community building projects like hashtag taco trucks at every mosque, hashtag I stand with hijabs, and hashtag sanctuary mosque that redefine Latino and Muslim narratives and promote positive social, cultural, and political change. In 2016, she organized 7 food tours in a culturally diplomatic way to bring Latinos to shop local, share a meal, and get to know their neighborhoods at an ethnic enclave called Little Arabia. In 2017, with Benjamin Vasquez, she launched hashtag taco trucks at every mosque, hashtag taco truck at every mosque, which instantly created a cultural revolution by bringing Latino and Muslim communities together nationally. It was quoted that fighting hate one halal taco at a time. She was featured on NPR, NBC, and CBS Nightly News, Univision, LA Times, Mitu, and profiled on Fusion TV's The Brave podcast as the Pink Hijabi California Girl. She was recognized as one of OC Weekly's 30 people over 20 years that changed Orange County and one of Orange County Register's 100 most influential in 2016 and 2017. She has been a social worker for the community for the last 10 years, advocating for refugees, women's rights, crisis intervention with child welfare issues, domestic violence, and suicide prevention. She is the first hijab observing Muslim to work for a public office in Orange County and currently works as a labor and health deputy for California State Assembly, serves as a chair of the Refugee Forum of OC and the chair of Anaheim Cultural and Heritage Commission. So it is truly an honor to have you here. Thank you very much.
It's funny that he says that because to me, I'm just a mom and my son is just like, he thinks that like all of those things don't matter. He just wants to have breakfast in the morning.
So thank you for the time for coming to talk with us and speak to us and share your perspective within this interfaith dialogue. We'll be using the next 20 or so minutes to hear from Rida and experience and perspectives of practicing the Islamic faith. So I would like to start with some broad questions. You did a fantastic job, especially bringing forth the prayer and explaining it. So I have a few questions that we've discussed and were provided by the church, some of which if you want to go into or say that you've already addressed, you feel free to. But first I want to start off with, what does Islam mean to you?
So Islam is a philosophy to me. It's a way of life. And I choose to be Muslim every single day. I do recognize that I was born Muslim, but I think Islamically, like, I make that choice to be a practicing Muslim. So Islam to me means that I personally feel a sense of obligation to serve others. And I explain that in the verses of the Quran, how God blesses us with his grace and his mercy, and it's really our responsibility to serve others with that grace and that mercy. And so in order for me to be a Muslim, a true Muslim, I really have to not judge people. And I think that it's important for me to always recognize that I'm not God and that nobody that ever tries to tell me like who I need to be is those people are not God, and thank God that they're not, because people are pretty hard and they lack a lot of times mercy, and they're very judgmental, especially in these days being Muslim and trying to fight that judgment against me. But yeah, being Muslim, by the way, is adhering to Islam, so like a Christian adheres to Christianity. So it's being a person of just constant mindfulness that this life is very short, and what did I do to serve others?
Thank you. It's a great lead into the next question, which is, what does God mean in Islam?
So, Islamically, we announce that we are Muslims and those that convert to Islam by stating, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadan Rasulullah. La ilaha illallah means there is only one God, and he has no partner, no child. He is one, and he is the creator of all things, the heavens, the universe, the angels, the devil, unfortunately, just everything. And so this idea that God is around us all the time, we don't have a definition of what God looks like, and we don't ascribe to God as a person, because that makes him not infallible, and so in this case that he is, and he can't make any mistakes, and he's the all-knowing. He knows everything. There are actually 99 names of God, and like I said earlier in the verse of Quran, God is Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, the most compassionate, the most merciful. So God actually said, there's a verse in the Quran that says, God, think of me as you will. If you think I'm the punisher, I am the punisher. If you think of me as, you know, your savior, as the person that will rescue you, I am that. But knowing that, if you only think of me as the punisher, you're going to see Islam as a very fearful religion, right? But if you think of me as, like, the most noble, the most, and that's one of Al-Karim, is the most noble. You will then look to me as a sense or as a source of guidance. If you think of me as the most merciful, you will look at me as a source of guidance as to how to treat people when you're in a difficult position and you want to, like, punch him in the face, right? you will think of me when you have a conflict in your own morals where you want to have fun, but you know that maybe having fun or being happy is not always healthy, right? So I think when I think of God, I think of all of his names, all of his beautiful names, but most importantly, I think of the most merciful.
Thank you. I understand that Arabic is a central language to Islam. Why is that?
In the 6th century, I mentioned La ilaha illallah Muhammadan Rasulullah. The second part is Muhammadan Rasulullah, which Muhammad is the prophet and the last messenger. And so in 600, there was a lot of corruption in the Middle East. And as a Muslim, I believe in the Quran, but the Quran also mentions the stories of the Torah and the stories of the Bible. And many of you obviously noticed that the prophets were Jews, right? And they came to the Jewish people to kind of help them and save them. And the people spoke Hebrew at the time. But in the Middle East, where Saudi Arabia, Mecca, particularly Medina, that area, it was a time where Arabs were very corrupt. They were treating women like slaves, and the idea of this incubine, the harem, came before Islam, where men would treat women like they could choose. They had many women in their home, and they could choose which one they would sleep with at night. And that corruption of idols, there was purchasing like million what would be today like $1 million idols to pray to, right? And the prophet was living at that time, and he was only 20 years old, and he was struggling with with how women were treated, how the rich were really not distributing the wealth, and they were spending all this money on these idols to say, look, my God is bigger than your God. And there was also a lot of, the poor were just treated like animals. And so they were slaves. They couldn't even get jobs. They just were slaves. So this is a time in which Angel Gabriel revealed the Quran in Arabic, because those were Arabs at the time, and still, like, the Arab culture inherited a lot of those corrupt patriarchal ideas, but it was Islam that guided them, and they had to be guided in Arabic because that was the language that they spoke. So that is why the Quran is in Arabic, because that was for the Arabs. Just like, you know, historically, the Jews had their own issues, right? And then the Pharaoh and all of the corruption with that. And then you had Moses, and you had, like, prophets like Joseph that came and restored faith and restored order and compassion. And so that messenger of Islam, Muhammad, being the final messenger, he was a person. He died. He is not divine at all. We don't worship Muhammad. And that's really important to understand, because some people think that, and I've read it in some academia perspectives, that they call Islam Muhammadism. That is not an appropriate term for Islam. Islam means to submit. It means peace. And if you submit, there's some type of, like, peace that you get from submitting to something. You accept some things, right? And there's a sense of peace when you accept. So Islam is just to accept that there is one God, and he is creator of all, and that Muhammad is the last messenger among the messengers before him, right? Which we believe in Abraham and even Adam as the first prophet in Islam.
Thank you. How diverse is the population of individuals practicing the Islamic faith?
That's a really good question. So Islam is a religion. It is not a culture. My culture is, I'm Palestinian, so I guess, like, my culture is Arab culture, right? But my faith is Islam. And those two sometimes conflict. Let me give you a perfect example. So Arabs love to dance. And I went to my brother's wedding in Palestine in the West Bank, and I was scolded by my grandmother and my great-grandmother because I was not dancing at the wedding. And they were like, how could you not be dancing? You need to look happy. We dance. That's how we show how happy we are. And I said, well, I mean, Islamically, I want to be modest. And there's a bunch of men here, and I'm not comfortable. And so, like, as a sign of discipline, I'm not dancing in front of the men. And my grandmother was like, I pray 5 times a day. I went to Hajj 3 times. You are not a better Muslim than me. You need to go and dance. Right? And so I was like, okay. So that culture was a priority over the faith, because I need to show my happiness in for my family. And so the diversity of Islam is really important to recognize, because it is not your quintessential Arab version of Islam. Although the language is recited in Arabic, in the Quran, it could be translated in any language and still be a Quran. So the fastest growing religion for the American culture is actually, the fastest growing community is they're Latinos. And the largest Muslim community in America are African American. And the largest Muslim population worldwide, can anybody answer that question? Asian, right. And not just Indonesia, but there are also Malaysians, there's Chinese Muslims, there's Vietnamese Muslims, there's Cambodian Muslims. And I think that when you start looking at, oh, okay, you could be Arab and be Russian. I mean, you could be Muslim and be Russian. You could be Muslim and be Latino. You could be Muslim and be Cuban, right? I come from a family where my half of my family are actually Latino, but I'm not Latino. They first immigrated in 1967 to Peru, and many of them settled and stayed there. So I have second and third generation Peruvian cousins. And they don't say they're American, or they don't say that they're Arab. They say they're Peruvian. And they speak first Spanish. And, you know, my father came here through Peru, and he chose to come here at 19 years old, and that was how many people got their visas at the time. They had to go through these Latin countries. So it's just important to see that Muslims are everyday people. They're every one of you could be possibly Muslim, right? It's not, there's a huge Muslim Caucasian community, and they're being targeted the most, I would say, as well as the African-American Muslims, because sometimes they're seen as sleeper cells. Mm. Like, oh, you're a white Muslim? Why? You know, it's kind of concerning when we're always questioned as to what our ethnicity is and our faith, and trying to, like, classify our intentions. So, I hope that answers your question about the diversity of Islam. It is, there's 1.2 billion Muslims, some people say 1.3 billion Muslims worldwide. It's the fastest, largest religion growing outside of Christianity.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I wanted to focus the conversation on a few specific questions regarding the beliefs and practice within Islam. Sometimes there's a misconceptions or misunderstanding based on larger social context. You touched on it, but I don't know if there's anything else you'd like to add to, like, what Sharia law is. Do you feel like that was, do you feel comfortable with that being addressed?
So Sharia law is, it's basically religious law, right? But I will tell you what you don't know about Sharia law. So I've been divorced twice, and that I was able to do through Sharia law. And Muslim women have the right to get divorced, and that's in Sharia law. Another part of Sharia law is that I have the right to inherit not only my father, his wealth, or his land. He has a lot of land in the West Bank. But I'm also allowed to inherit my spouse's wealth, right? But with that, Islamically, by Sharia law, whatever I earn, I get to keep. My husband doesn't have the right to inherit my wealth by Sharia law. I have to give him permission. That's pretty awesome when it comes to women's rights, right? Because this assumption that women are oppressed, and this assumption that women don't have rights, and that this Western culture is really, like, giving us these rights, is actually inaccurate, because in 600, when there were many of the pagan worshipers and even Christians and Jews at the time, didn't have those Islamic rights for women. The prophet's wife was an entrepreneur. She married him, and he was 25 years old, and guess how old she was? 40. By Islamic law, you could choose to marry, and in this idea that women are submissive, right? That's a cultural misconception, by the way. And that's where the culture and the conflict of the faith are always hand in hand. So when I get told, like, by people in my community, sometimes when I'm breaking stereotypes and really making change, and especially in Little Arabia, where there's a large Arab-owned, man-oriented business cultural perspective, they're like, why are you doing this? I'm like, Islamically, I can, right? And that's conflict with their cultural patriarchal expectation of who I need to be. And a lot of times I have to explain to them, I don't need to ask you for permission to lead Arabs or Muslims in this community or market our community to be an economic powerhouse in Anaheim. I don't need your permission. And that scares men in my culture because they're like, oh, she's breaking she's deviating for our cultural norms. And what happens when she does that, other women will do that. But women in Islam have been doing that since the 600s. Because one of the things that we have to practice by Sharia law is women's right to education. We have to actually, it's actually an obligation. And so when you think of a country like Afghanistan, where a lot of women are not allowed to go to school, or in Pakistan, that's actually against Islamic law. And so that's kind of the difference of what you hear from the media of what Islamic law is and what the reality of me practicing Islamic law. It's been my power, actually. And I've been divorced twice, and I pretty much got all my rights and more than what the 50-50 of what American society would get in California law.
Thank you. You've touched upon this, and I was wondering, so it's not uncommon within Christian and other faith communities to face challenges based on gender roles and identities, as you've discussed. Within America, we are also witnessing challenges to a patriarchal system in various forms. With that being said, is it challenging to be a prominent leader within the Muslim community as a woman? And what does your faith inform you of your stance on this issue?
So like I said, I use my faith to empower my right and to enforce my right to do things, especially within my culture. And when I walk into, and I've been invited to many boardrooms to educate about public policy or access to elected officials and how they could lobby, I've noticed a lot of times there are no women, not even one. I mean, Islamic settings, like I could name three mosques that don't have any women on the board. And this is not to say that this is the case also, this is not the case with some mosques, some temples and some churches, right? But I'm owning in on my community, and so I always say, I'm not going to speak to a board if there are no women in it. And that doesn't always, I literally was kicked out of one of my meetings one time where they were like, oh, Raida, she works for Loretta Sanchez, and we need to get her on our side. We need to try to get some resources from her. Let her speak to our board. So I came into the board meeting, and they knew, by the way, that I won't speak to a board without a woman in the board. So I came into the meeting, and it was midday, and I don't know why they made the meeting in the middle of the day, but okay. And I said, where's the women? You told me that you have a woman on the board. Oh, yeah, she's at home. I was like, excuse me? She's on your board when she's at home? What's the purpose of her being part of the board if she's not present? And she's not being, you know, she's not participating. And they're like, you know what? This is not what we came to ask you about. We wanted to know how we could, you know, access resources for our mosque. And you're telling us, you know, that why is this woman at home? And to be fair, it's not a mainstream mosque. It's not one of the ones that you work with. But I was like, you know what? By the way, while we're at it, I don't really appreciate the way you're speaking to me, you know? And I would ask you to please be respectful when I'm asking this of you, because Islamically, like, we're supposed to run the mosque to serve men and women, And if the men are serving and dictating what's going to happen, then the women's voices are not being heard. And I don't feel like I'm being heard because you're trying to silence me right now. And so they're like, okay, you could leave. And I was like, all right. And I was walking out and I saw all these like campaign posters. And I was like, by the way, while you're at it, these shouldn't be on here. Like, you guys wanted me to give you some advice. It's just like compromising your 501(c)(3). And they're like, oh, now you want to tell us to take down our signs? I'm like, but you, okay, bye. But it was interesting because I realized that they want you to be present if you're conveniently doing what they want you to do. And they will, and I'm not saying that there aren't good Muslim men that are speaking fairly and actively trying to be inclusive for women's participation and leadership in our community, because there are. Unfortunately, that's not the vast majority. And it's not because of the faith, but it's because of the cultures that are very male-dominated, right? And so I really struggle with that, because a lot of people don't want a woman that's going to tell them the truth. They want women that are going to be extensions of them. And so I think that I see that not just in our faith, in our cultural community, but in extension of even working in public office. There are only 26 California legislatures that are women, and there are a total of 80 seats. And the same thing goes with Congress, right? There are actually more women in elected seats in the Middle East and in Pakistan and South Asia than in our country. So that really conflicts with this idea that patriarchy is just an Arab or Asian issue or a Latino issue. This is actually an American issue as well.
Thank you. I know we're coming to the end of our time, but what I'd like to ask is, what would you like as a takeaway for members of our communities and others to know about the Muslim community?
I would like for us, when we go and we protest, and I know that you are a gracious, very supportive community to Muslims, and I know you're always there on the forefront, and we really appreciate that, and we love you for that. But I would also ask you, when you go home and you see that you have a neighbor that's Muslim, that it's okay to knock on the door and ask them, you know, over for dinner, or give them a plant to show in good faith that, you know, we're here for you. I organize in a fashion where I don't usually organize with political people. So the Latino Muslim Unity is a movement to bridge Latinos and Muslims, and many of them are Muslim Latinos too, but it's important to participate in a space where we're inclusive of apolitical people and that are not part of our usual dialogue and are not part of our progressive spaces, because this is a great progressive space. But a lot of times we go and we fight and we're at the picket line, but we go home, we don't even know who we can actually say, or if we have a Muslim friend. And if you have a question, never feel afraid to ask that question. It's better to ask than to assume. And all Muslims are different. I was a victim of domestic violence. I could tell you that my husband was American. He was born in this country. And actually, I chose to marry him because I was like, I don't want to marry somebody from my community, right? Because I don't want patriarchy to, like, be in my household. But guess what? That's a human issue. It's a universal issue. And I had the right Islamically to get divorced because I didn't feel safe. And so it's just important to see that there are different types of Muslims too. You could be gay and Muslim. You could be, you can't be atheist and Muslim, because Islamically the idea is the oneness of God and to believe in God. But there are different types of practicing, even hijabis. Hijab is my headscarf. I bought this from Forever 21. It's important to know that this is just a scarf, and it's not some foreign, you know, I didn't buy it from some foreign place. And I have many different types that I wear, and they're all pink because I feel like pink emanates happiness and like kind of disarms people to come and talk to me. But the idea of hijab itself is a choice. And you were supposed to ask me, like, when is a woman supposed to wear hijab? Islamically, it's supposed to be at puberty. I wore hijab when I turned 13. And my mom was like, you're not wearing that. Right? So this assumption that this is forced upon you, like my own mother said, no, I don't want you to wear that. I will not be seen with you. At that time, she was not a practicing Muslim. It made her very uncomfortable. And it made her feel like, I don't want other people to think that I'm forcing you to do this. I actually did take it off, but because I didn't receive the support. And then it wasn't until I got divorced that I wore the hijab. So this idea that women wear hijab for their husbands, actually, my husband wouldn't let me wear hijab either. So it's important for you to see that everything that you're being told is actually not always accurate, and to question, because there are special interests always, even in the Muslim community. And I will be the first to say, I don't trust every imam, right? They're not perfect. And I used to glorify them growing up. And that Islam is accessible by a book. You don't need to be taught it by a person. Actually, most people that ever taught me Islam, I didn't really get inspired. I learned through my own experiences and reading, and I studied Islamic civilization in Spain and Morocco. And with UCLA, sad to say that I had to like learn through the academic process, and it helped me question a lot of my beliefs. So when I wore hijab, I wore it at 24 years old. And I felt empowered. To me, hijab was my liberation, not having to adhere to this expectation of what I needed to look like, but also be proud to publicly say I'm Muslim. And it's for me, hijab is an act of worship, like you would wear a cross or you would wear a yarmulke. And it is very personal, but at the same time, it reminds me constantly, like, if I'm going to a bar because of political reasons, because that's where, like, we're meeting, I have to explain to them, like, I'm not going to sit next to the bar. You know, like, I'm going to sit on the outside, and then no one's going to ask me to drink alcohol, right? I'm not going to acquiesce to my environment because everyone else is drinking. But the same token, like, if there's gossip in my office, I'm not going to adhere to that. Like, because my hijab is always like it's a mindful of like a badge of honor that I always have to adhere to. Kind of like, no, I don't want to use example of a cop, but, you know, you wear a uniform, and this is my uniform that I wear every single day with different types of clothes. And it's just being looking in the mirror and putting it on and making a choice every single day to put it on, because this is me actively worshiping God.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add or share that we were not able to discuss?
Has anybody been to Little Arabia? So I would love to invite you guys all for free to do like a Little Arabia tour. It's in Anaheim, and it's off of Brookhurst, and there's kind of a corridor between the 5 freeway that goes down Brookhurst all the way down to Katala, and that's where the beginning of Little Saigon starts. And so there are Arab-owned restaurants, and hospitality is like their biggest strength. And so when you come into these restaurants, they really treat you like you're at your mom's kitchen. And I really want you guys to have that option to kind of engage with our community, not just as me preaching to you, but like me serving you and having a conversation, because I feel like the best way to a person's heart is through food. And I personally don't like talking to people when I haven't eaten. I get hangry. And so it's just very disarming when you're eating and you're sharing a meal that's very biologically like nourishing. And so your mind is like open and your heart is open. So that's really what our projects with Latino and Muslim unity is about. Like the halal taco, I came up with that concept because in 2016, Marcos Gutierrez, Latinos for Trump founder, was saying, if you're not careful, there's gonna be a taco truck at every corner. And I'm like, that's awesome. Let me bring a taco truck to every mosque. And I kid you not, these mosques are like, without me now having taco trucks. And then I introduced this idea, well, if we're gonna bring these two communities together, we have to be culturally sensitive, so I can't give them al pastor or carnitas. I have to make sure the meat is halal, which means permissible by God. And it just means that the way in which, there's really no humane way of killing an animal, but that the animal doesn't suffer. And that when the animal is slaughtered, you say Bismillah in the name of God so that animal doesn't die in vain. And that the meat, the animal cannot be sick, it cannot be bruised, and they can't have any type of injections. So it's really kind of like organic, but like even better than that. So this worry that like, oh my God, it was the funniest thing out of all of the experience I've had working with Latino and Muslim unity, I was told by a Trump supporter one time, I'm not gonna eat your halal taco. You're trying to convert me to Islam. I was like, really? Let me give you a kosher hot dog so you can be converted to Judaism. Like, that's not how it works, right? But it's really important for us to be able to connect by food because I feel like it does like have a positive experience with one another, that we need to be able to open our hearts and open our minds to listening to one another. And I usually eat, so I'm listening really well when someone's talking to me when I'm eating. So I really invite you to come, and maybe I'll organize with CJ. One day we can come together, and you're all invited for free, and we could hop around different restaurants, and you can have a taste of Little Arabia.
That's an awesome opportunity. Thank you. And thank you so much for your time and all of your words today. We really, really appreciate you coming down here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is a blessing. Thank you so much. Thank you.